Wake up! I saw some of you nodding off during that. Genesis 5 is one of those parts of the Bible that most of us don't really ever read. The people who do read the Bible, even, tend to skip over chapters like Genesis 5. This is a sermon about the parts of the Bible that you never read. They're called genealogies. They take us back to the origin, where we come from, our genesis, if you will. Genesis 5 reminds us that God created us in His image and then talks about this line of humans from Seth, from Adam, actually, to Noah. Why are genealogies in the Bible? Why are they important? Why should we care? Genealogies remind us that the Bible is a story. And it helps us to see what kind of story the Bible is. And I hope by the end of the sermon today, you will be convinced that the genealogies are important and maybe even worth reading through when you read the Bible. I want to make five observations about genealogies to show how they help us and why they're actually essential to this to the biblical story. First observation is that genealogies show us that the primary structure of the Bible is story. This is a point I've made a number of times, but I try and emphasize it as much as possible. The Bible is a story before anything else. And I emphasize it because too often I think we read it as something else. We read it as a list of rules for living, or a bunch of philosophical concepts, or some random fables, or great quotes to write down. And even some of the ways we read it, treat it like that. Some of our devotionals, you have one verse at a time picked kind of randomly from various parts of the Bible. The Bible is a story. There are laws, there are some great one-liners in the Bible, and it does deal with philosophy and all of these things. But all of those are part of the story. And it's important that we understand them within the storyline. Just as an example, the Ten Commandments. We kind of take Ten Commandments out of context, and we often think of them as kind of this individual moral code. But it's important that we understand the Ten Commandments and how they came to a nation that had just been, or a people, I should say, that have just been called out of slavery. And God, in His might and in His grace, delivers them out of slavery. And they're about to go into the Promised Land and become a new nation. And so that's when the Ten Commandments come in. Not as just a list of rules for individuals, but as principles to form this new community. That the people want to obey because they trust God for having delivered them and having their best interest in mind. When we read parts of the Bible without knowing the story, it's like taking one scene out of a movie and watching it. And sometimes we think, oh, the Bible doesn't make sense. This is confusing. There are so many different parts that we don't get. It's like taking that scene out of a movie. We're not supposed to get it on its own. These different parts and forms in the Bible are meant to be understood within the whole storyline of the Bible. And genealogies keep us from de-storifying the story. Keep us from seeing it as a random collection and missing what the Bible really is. The genealogies are the glue or the fabric that holds the story together. Second observation. Genealogies show us that the Bible is a family-based story. When we think history, when we're taught history in school and our history classes, we tend to think political history. You know, how nations came about and kings and rulers and things like that. Or we think military history, or we think geological history. And we are taught those things within the structures of big timelines, or even maps that show different countries or geological structures. And those are appropriate ways of telling political or military or geological history. But Israel, which is kind of the subject of most of this story, was formed in a family context. It was a nation, it was a people built on families and the family structure. And so genealogies, which trace that family structure and descendants and offspring and things like that, is the most fitting way of telling a family history. They're kind of like, the genealogies are kind of like a coat rack. And as you go down the coat rack, there are these different hangers where you hang the different stories about these individuals. And so we go down the coat rack, and then there's Noah, and we have a place to hang his story on. It's a story of God's promise being passed on like an heirloom among family members. The lessons that we learn here are family lessons. It's a story about how do we live in this family called Israel or the church. So the genealogies show us that the Bible is a family-based story, and they're the most appropriate way of telling that story. Third observation. Genealogies show us that we are not on a historical island. More and more, we in our culture are on historical islands. We get so focused on us and now and moving forward and the newest and latest thing that many of us are further and further disconnected from our family stories, from our national stories. We don't know our history very well. And I think that that is a dangerous place to be if we are not rooted in history, in our story. I think every history class I ever took, on the first day, the professor asked the question, why do we take history? And the answer every year was that, quote, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. It's dangerous not to know history because we keep stumbling over the same stumbling blocks over and over again. But it's also confusing to be on a historical island. It's confusing to our identity, to who we are. In our culture, we get this message that our identity as people comes from within. We're very individualistic. Our identity comes from inside of ourselves. We have to discover, look inside, and discover our identity. I think that is a confusing and not very helpful way of looking at it. Instead, I think our identity comes from the various stories that converge in our lives. The stories of our family, the stories of our culture and our nation, various stories of our friends and people we know, they converge in our lives. And we get to choose which story we live out. But we have to know where the story comes from, to know where we come from, to really understand and be able to choose wisely who we are going to be, what story or stories we are going to live out. Genealogies connect us to our spiritual history, to our spiritual ancestors. And some of them were great, faithful people. And some of them were great, colossal failures. Some of them are just names in these lists, and we don't know their stories. But what they show us is we are not the first to struggle with walking with God or loving God or serving God in a broken world. We're not the first to go through this thing of faith and of as Christians. Genealogies show us what it looks like to do that. It encourages us with some of the stories of our spiritual ancestors who are faithful. It warns us with some of the stories of our spiritual ancestors who weren't. But they connect us to the story. Genealogies show us we're not on a historical island. Fourth, genealogies show us that the point of the story is Jesus. The point of the story is Jesus. I'm going to linger on this point for a little bit, if you don't mind. All of the non-story-based ways that we read the Bible, as rules, as quotes, as inspirational quotes or fables, we keep asking this question, what does it mean for me? And we assume it's about me, ultimately. The Bible is for me. And in one sense, it kind of is. But it's not a story, first and foremost, about us. The Bible is a story of the Promised One. It's a story of promise. It follows. The storyline is a storyline about a promise. It's a story about the rescuer, a savior, a king, someone who would make this world right. And genealogies help us to follow that story. Now, in the last few weeks, we've looked at Eve, Adam and Eve. And we saw in Genesis 3:15 that this promise comes in, where it says there's going to be this battle, and the offspring of the woman will strike the head of the serpent, you know, that embodies evil, and crush that serpent's head, even though the serpent will strike the offspring of the woman's foot. Do you guys remember that at all? Okay, so there's this promise that one day, good will be victorious over evil. Things will be made right. The curse will be reversed, so to speak. And that begins this story of trying to figure out who this promised one is. And last week we saw the story of Cain. And Cain, of course, was Eve's firstborn. And as you're reading the story, you're thinking maybe this is the promised one. This is the offspring of the woman, the one who's been promised. But of course, as we read the story, as we looked at the story, we realized, no, Cain is very much not the promised one, as he kills his brother Abel, and obviously Abel isn't the promised one anymore either. In Genesis 5, or at the end of Genesis 4, we're introduced to Seth. And like as Cain's genealogy kind of broke off, in Genesis 5 we get Seth's genealogy, and we see that this is the one we're supposed to follow. If we want to find God's promised one, we have to follow Seth's offspring, Seth's descendants. That's a hard name to say, I'm realizing. And we realize that if we want to follow this story, we have to follow Seth. And that's what we read today, Seth's genealogy. And his genealogy takes us to Noah. And of course, we're going to look over the next few weeks at Noah's story. But we know that Noah is in this line of promise. And we're introduced to his three sons, Shem and Ham and Japheth. And we're going to see that some of their genealogies drop off, and we continue on just one of their lines. And that line takes us eventually to Abraham. And that genealogy is in Genesis 10. And we say, okay, Abraham is this line of promise. We're following Abraham's story now. And that takes us to his two sons, Ishmael and Isaac. And Ishmael has a genealogy, but that breaks off. And so we realize, okay, Isaac is the one we're following. And Isaac has sons, Jacob and Esau. And Esau's genealogy drops off, and we realize that we're now following Jacob's story. And if we want to find this promised one, we need to follow Jacob's line. And as we move into Jacob's story, he has 12 sons, and now it's really confusing because we're like, okay, whose story are we following now? And for a while, we think we're following Joseph's story. You probably know Joseph, you know, Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat Joseph? And he has a big part of Genesis, about 14 chapters, but there's this random chapter in Genesis 38 that talks about Jacob's son, Judah. And it seems really out of place, and you're wondering why it's there. But at the end of the story, Judah has a son named Perez, and you've probably never heard of Perez. But I want you to hold that name in your mind for a second, because we're going to fast forward to the book of Ruth. And the book of Ruth is this really neat kind of love story between Ruth, this Moabite woman, and she meets Boaz, who's this Israelite. And it's a nice story, and we take it, and sometimes it's read at weddings even. But at the end of the book of Ruth, you know what there is? There's a genealogy. And this genealogy shows us how Boaz is connected, is a descendant of Perez. And so he is part of this line of promise as we read the story. And Boaz and Ruth, they have a son, Obed, and Obed becomes the father of Jesse, and Jesse becomes the father of David. And it's that David. You know, as our high school kids walked out, one of them was dressed as David. And he's this king, this great king in the middle of the story. And God makes a promise to him, like he made a promise to Eve about the promised one. And he made a promise to Abraham that one day one of his offspring would bless all of the nations. He makes a promise to David that from his line there will be this king who will reign forever. Then we get into the books of 1 and 2 Kings. And if you just take those out of context, all of a sudden you think we're doing political history. Because we're telling these stories about kings and nations and military stuff going on. But if you've been reading the story, you realize that we're still following this line of promise to David's son Solomon, and Solomon's son, and so on. And we have good kings like Hezekiah and bad kings like Manasseh on this line. But the story keeps going until we come to this king named Jehoiachin, one of David's descendants. And you've all heard of Jehoiachin, I'm sure. Jehoiachin... Jehoiachin was a king when Babylon came in and they destroyed Jerusalem, and they sent all of these, the kings and the rulers, all these people out of Jerusalem. And there's this moment in the story where we're wondering, is this going to happen? Where does this line go? Until about 70 years later, the Israelites come back into Jerusalem and they have a king, and his name is Zerubbabel. And another guy who's, you know, really famous. But Zerubbabel, you're wondering, where does he come from? And you know those boring books of 1 and 2 Chronicles that have all these genealogies in there? Well, in 1 Chronicles 3, we see that Zerubbabel is a descendant of Jehoiachin. Of course, he's a descendant of David, and we go back and forth in this story. Now, after Zerubbabel, there's this period of history that gets really muddled and confusing for a lot of reasons. We have these kind of fake kings and military heroes and priests that rise up and become the leaders of this people, and it gets really confusing until we get to the Gospels. And we begin in the Gospel of Matthew. And can anyone guess how the Gospel of Matthew begins? Anyone know? With a genealogy. And this genealogy at the beginning of Matthew takes us all the way back to Abraham and that promise. And it talks about Abraham's descendants. As we read this genealogy, we see people like Isaac and Jacob and Judah and Perez and who else have we talked about? David, of course, and some of David's descendants, Solomon and Hezekiah. And then we come to Zerubbabel. And if we were wondering what happened to Zerubbabel, Matthew 1 talks about his descendants. And we read about Zerubbabel's descendants one by one until we read Jacob, who was the father of Joseph, who was the husband of Mary, who gave birth to Jesus, who is called the Messiah. And then the genealogies end. Why? Well, first of all, Jesus didn't have any kids. But second of all, he was the point of the story. He was the promised one that would crush the serpent's head. He was the one who was promised to Abraham, who would become a blessing to all nations. He was the forever king that was promised to David, that we've been waiting for and hoping for and trusting God for all of these years throughout this whole story. Jesus is the point. He is the promise that is at the conclusion of this line of promise that we've been following throughout the story. And I didn't do this to show off my Bible knowledge. Okay? I did this to show you, hopefully, that the Bible is not a random collection of stories. It is a story about a promise that is passed on from one generation to the next, and the genealogies are the vehicle that get us from the promise that God makes way back in the beginning and throughout to the fulfillment of the promise that is Jesus, the Messiah. The point of the story is Jesus. And this leads to the fifth observation. Genealogies show us that this is a living story. A couple years ago, I decided that I would try and read the Bible front to back, cover to cover. I tried it once before, a couple years earlier, and I failed miserably at it. So if you've tried and kind of got lost in Leviticus, don't feel bad. But this time, I made it through. And over this year, there were many surprises that came out of this reading to me. But maybe the most surprising thing that I encountered over that year was that I actually enjoyed the genealogies, reading them. And for those of you who had an inkling that I was a little weird, this is just confirmation for you. And those of you who didn't really think that, now you're kind of rethinking your whole perspective on your pastor. I enjoyed the genealogies. Because as I read the genealogies, I came to this realization that this is my story. These are my people. These are my ancestors. They are the ones clinging to the same hope that I'm clinging to. Trusting in the same promises of forgiveness and freedom that I'm trusting in. They're having some of the same struggles and failures that I have and we have as we try and follow God and trust in Him. These genealogies are not a line of heroes that we're supposed to emulate. Because we're going to be real confused if we think this line is a line of heroes. This is not a line of heroes, it's a line of promise. A line of trusting what God is doing. And on this line, in this story, there are some bizarre and wonderful and disturbing and surprising and beautiful and disappointing things that happen. And you know what I realized? That's our lives. This story has some amazing examples of faith. And it has some bone-chilling warnings about what happens when we try and live life our own way apart from God. The story is unpredictable. It's up and down. It's sometimes God's will is clear, sometimes God's will is foggy. And that's our lives, isn't it? But as I read, and I think this came sometime around the prophets, I started to realize that yes, this promise is coming true. And all those points where it seemed like, I don't know how this can happen. This story is derailed. These people have failed. And you start to wonder. But as you read, you realize this is happening. God is going to fulfill His promise. Reading the Bible is kind of like watching a plant grow. You plant the seed, and you wonder, you know, what's going to happen. And that's kind of like Genesis 1 and 2. You know, something's planted in the soil of this earth. You're wondering, what's going to happen? And especially when Eve and Adam fall in Genesis 3, what is going on? What is God doing? But as you watch a plant grow and it starts to break through the soil and you start to see the stalk coming up, you start to have a little more hope. It's still precarious, but you have hope. And as the plant keeps growing and growing, you start to say, get excited. Start to be very anticipatory about what is going to happen. What is this flower that's going to come as this plant grows? And the Bible blooms all of a sudden in the New Testament in Jesus. This beautiful fulfillment, this beautiful flower that is the fulfillment of all of these promises, everything we need and hope for, comes true. The key is you cannot take the flower off of the stalk and expect it to be beautiful and thrive. And that's what we so often do with Jesus. For a flower, all of the nutrients and stability and growth comes from the stalk as it comes from the roots up through the leaves and then into the flower. And that's what this story is. This is all part of the same flower. It's a story that brings us to Jesus. As I got to the end of the story, I came upon a book called Hebrews. And in Hebrews 11, there is this beautiful chapter. It's almost like a genealogy, except it's not all about the line of promise. It's a genealogy of faith. And in it, you see people like Abel, and you see people like Abraham and Daniel. And you see people who have trusted in God's promises, no matter what. Even when it didn't seem like it could happen. These are people who trusted them, no matter what it cost them. And when I got to Hebrews 12, after this whole genealogy of faith, if you will, Hebrews 12 begins like this. Since then, we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, surrounded by all these people I just mentioned who are part of this story too. Since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us cast off our sin, throw off everything that entangles us, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. Through all of the joys and the sorrows, through all of the stumbling and hoping of the story, through all of the things our lives and these lives have gone through, it all is leading us to the promised one, to Jesus, who makes all things right. And as we read this story and understand this story, we realize that it's our story. And it's a story that we can join if we're looking for hope, if we're looking for fulfillment and freedom and truth and an eternity spent with the Creator of this world. This is our story. Let's live it. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, what a wonderful story you've given us. And Lord, as we look at our lives sometimes and wonder, how in the world are you working here? What in the world do you have in store for us? How can your promises possibly be fulfilled in my life? How can your promises possibly be fulfilled in this world where there are wars and death and pain and struggle? Lord, draw us back into your story where there is a promised one. There is hope. There is a king who will reign forever, who makes all things right. Help us to trust you. Help us to live your story. Help us to show the world what a beautiful promise you have made, what a beautiful fulfillment you've given us, and what a beautiful future we have in your kingdom. Amen.